Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2. On the Man Called Christ. Chapter 6. The Five Deaths of the Faith. Part 1. It is not the purpose of this book to trace the subsequent history of Christianity, especially the later history of Christianity, which involves controversies of which I hope to write more fully elsewhere. It is devoted only to the suggestion that Christianity, appearing amid heathen humanity, had all the character of a unique thing, and even of a supernatural thing. It was not like any of the other things. And the more we study it, the less it looks like any of them. But there is a certain rather peculiar character which marked it henceforward, even down to the present moment, with a note on which this book may well conclude. I have said that Asia and the ancient world had an air of being too old to die. Christendom has had the very opposite fate. Christendom has had a series of revolutions, and in each one of them, Christianity has died. Christianity has died many times and risen again, for it had a God who knew the way out of the grave. But the first extraordinary fact which marks this history is this, that Europe has been turned upside down over and over again, and that at the end of each of these revolutions, the same religion has again been found on top. The faith is always converting the age, not as an old religion, but as a new religion. The truth is hidden from many by a convention that is too little noticed. Curiously enough, it is a convention of the sort which those who ignore it claim especially to detect and denounce. They are always telling us that priests and ceremonies are not religion, and that religious organization can be a hollow sham. But they hardly realize how true it is. It is so true that 3 or 4 times at least in the history of Christendom, the whole soul seemed to have gone out of Christianity, and almost every man in his heart expected its end. This fact is only masked in medieval and other times by that very official religion which such critics pride themselves on seeing through. Christianity remained the official religion of a Renaissance prince or the official religion of an 18th century bishop, just as an ancient mythology remained the official religion of Julius Caesar, or the Arian Creed long remained the official religion of Julian the Apostate. But there was a difference between the cases of Julius and of Julian, because the church had begun its strange career. There was no reason why men like Julius should not worship gods like Jupiter forever in public, and laugh at them forever in private. But when Julian treated Christianity as dead, he found it had come to life again. He also found, incidentally, that there was not the faintest sign of Jupiter ever coming to life again. This case of Julian and the episode of Arianism is but the first of a series of examples that can only be roughly indicated here. Arianism, as has been said, had every human appearance of being the natural way in which that particular superstition of Constantine might be expected to peter out. All the ordinary stages had been passed through. The creed had become a respectable thing, had become a ritual thing, had then been modified into a rational thing, and the rationalists were ready to dissipate the last remains of it, just as they do today. When Christianity rose again suddenly and through them, it was almost as unexpected as Christ rising from the dead. But there are many other examples of the same thing, even about the same time. The rush of missionaries from Ireland, for instance, has all the air of an unexpected onslaught of young men on an old world, and even on a church that showed signs of growing old. Some of them were martyred on the coast of Cornwall, and the chief authority on Cornish antiquities told me that he did not believe for a moment that they were martyred by heathens, but, as he expressed with some humor, by rather slack Christians. Now, if we were to dip below the surface of history, as it is not in the scope of this argument to do, I suspect that we should find several occasions when Christendom was thus to all appearance hollowed out from within by doubt and indifference, so that only the old Christian shell stood as the pagan shell had stood so long. But the difference is that in every such case, the sons were fanatical for the faith where the fathers had been slack about it. This is obvious in the case of the transition from the Renaissance to the Counter-Reformation. It is obvious in the case of a transition from the 18th century to the many Catholic revivals of our own time. But I suspect many other examples which would be worthy of separate studies. The faith is not a survival. It is not as if the Druids had managed somehow to survive somewhere for 2,000 years. That is what might have happened in Asia or ancient Europe, in that indifference or tolerance in which mythologies and philosophies could live forever side by side. It has not survived. It has returned again and again in this Western world of rapid change and institutions perpetually perishing. Europe, in the tradition of Rome, was always trying revolution and reconstruction, rebuilding a universal republic, and it always began by rejecting this old stone, and ended by making it the head of the corner, by bringing it back from the rubbish heap to make it the crown of the capital. Some stones of Stonehenge are standing, and some are fallen. And as the stone falleth, so shall it lie. There has not been a druidic renaissance every century or two, with the young druids crowned with fresh mistletoe, dancing in the sun on Salisbury Plain. Stonehenge has not been rebuilt in every style of architecture from the rude round Norman to the last Rococo of the Baroque. The sacred place of the druids is safe from the vandalism of restoration. But the church in the West was not in a world where things were too old to die, but in one in which they were always young enough to get killed. The consequence was that superficially and externally, it often did get killed. Nay, it sometimes wore out even without getting killed. And there follows a fact I find it somewhat difficult to describe, yet which I believe to be very real and rather important. As a ghost is the shadow of a man, and in that sense, the shadow of life, so at intervals there passed across this endless life a sort of shadow of death. It came at the moment when it would have perished had it been perishable. It withered away everything that was perishable. If such animal parallels were worthy of the occasion, we might say that the snake shuddered and shed a skin and went on, or even that the cat went into convulsions as it lost only one of its 999 lives. It is truer to say, in a more dignified image, that a clock struck and nothing happened, or that a bell tolled for an execution that was everlastingly postponed. What was the meaning of all that dim but vast unrest of the 12th century when, as it has been so finely said, Julian stirred in his sleep? Why did there appear so strangely early, in the twilight of dawn after the Dark Ages, so deep a skepticism as that involved in urging nominalism against realism. For realism against nominalism was really realism against rationalism, or something more destructive than what we call rationalism. The answer is that just as some might have thought the church simply a part of the Roman Empire, so others later might have thought the church only a part of the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages ended as the empire had ended, and the church should have departed with them if she had been also one of the shades of night. It was another of those spectral deaths, or simulations of death. I mean that if nominalism had succeeded, it would have been as if Arianism had succeeded. It would have been the beginning of a confession that Christianity had failed. For nominalism is a far more fundamental skepticism than mere atheism. Such was the question that was openly asked as the Dark Ages broadened into that daylight that we call the modern world. But what was the answer? The answer was Aquinas, in the chair of Aristotle, taking all knowledge for his province, and tens of thousands of lads, down to the lowest ranks of peasant and serf, living in rags and on crusts about the great colleges, to listen to the scholastic philosophy. What was the meaning of all that whisper of fear that ran round the West under the shadow of Islam, and fills every old romance with incongruous images of Saracen knights swaggering in Norway or the Hebrides? Why were men in the extreme West, such as King John, if I remember rightly, accused of being secretly Muslims, as men are accused of being secretly atheists? Why was there that fierce alarm among some of the authorities about the rationalistic Arab version of Aristotle? Authorities are seldom alarmed like that, except when it is too late. The answer is that hundreds of people probably believed in their hearts that Islam would conquer Christendom, that Averroes was more rational than Anselm, that the Saracen culture was really, as it was superficially, a superior culture. Here again, we should probably find a whole generation, the older generation, very doubtful and depressed and weary. The coming of Islam would only have been the coming of Unitarianism 1,000 years before its time. To many, it may have seemed quite reasonable, and quite probable, and quite likely to happen. If so, they would have been surprised at what did happen. What did happen was a roar like thunder from thousands and thousands of young men throwing all their youth into one exultant countercharge, the Crusades. It was the sons of St. Francis, the jugglers of God, wandering singing over all the roads of the world. It was the Gothic going up like a flight of arrows. It was the waking of the world. In considering the war of the Albigensians, we come to the breach in the heart of Europe and the landslide of a new philosophy that nearly ended Christendom forever. In that case, the new philosophy was also a very new philosophy. It was pessimism. It was, nonetheless, like modern ideas, because it was as old as Asia. Most modern ideas are. It was the Gnostics returning. But why did the Gnostics return? Because it was the end of an epoch, like the end of an empire, and should have been the end of the church. It was Schopenhauer hovering over the future. But it was also Manichaeus rising from the dead, that men might have death and that they might have it more abundantly. It is rather more obvious in the case of the Renaissance, simply because the period is so much nearer to us, and people know so much more about it. But there is more even in that example than most people know. Apart from the particular controversies which I wish to reserve for a separate study, the period was far more chaotic than those controversies commonly imply. When Protestants call Latimer a martyr to Protestantism, and Catholics reply that Campion was a martyr to Catholicism, it is often forgotten that many perished in such persecutions, who could only be described as martyrs to atheism, or anarchism, or even diabolism. That world was almost as wild as our own. The men wandering about in it included the sort of man who says there is no God, the sort of man who says he is himself God, the sort of man who says something that nobody can make head or tail of. If we could have the conversation of the age following the Renaissance, we should probably be shocked by its shameless negations. The remarks attributed to Marlowe are probably pretty typical of the talk in many intellectual taverns. The transition from pre-Reformation to post-Reformation Europe was through a void of very yawning questions. Yet again, in the long run, the answer was the same. It was one of those moments when, as Christ walked on the water, so was Christianity walking in the air. But all these cases are remote in date, and could only be proved in detail. We can see the fact much more clearly in the case when the paganism of the Renaissance ended Christianity, and Christianity unaccountably began all over again. But we can see it most clearly of all in the case which is close to us and full of manifest and minute evidence, the case of the great decline of religion that began about the time of Voltaire, for indeed it is our own case. And we ourselves have seen the decline of that decline. The 200 years since Voltaire do not flash past us at a glance, like the 4th and 5th centuries, or the 12th and 13th centuries. In our own case, we can see this oft-repeated process close at hand. We know how completely a society can lose its fundamental religion without abolishing its official religion. We know how men can all become agnostics long before they abolish bishops. And we know that also in this last ending, which really did look to us like the final ending, the incredible thing has happened again. The faith has a better following among the young men than among the old. When Ibsen spoke of the new generation knocking at the door, he certainly never expected that it would be the church door.
'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.